Thank you. Thanks for sticking with me here and hanging out on this last afternoon of the conference. I'd like to first acknowledge my co-authors, Cindy Camberdell at the ARS and Ames, Lisa Schulte Moore at Iowa State University, and Randy Kolka at the Forest Service up in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. And I'm going to be talking about some data from an experimental work that we're doing in Iowa, looking at soil aggregation differences and carbon saturation deficit differences across landscape positions. So ever since Tisdale and Oates proposed the hierarchical nature of aggregate formation for protection of organic matter, there's been a lot of work that's really shown the importance of this physical protection in soil aggregates for storing carbon in soils with increasing inputs. And then more recently, work has shown that in addition to this physically protected pool, there's also this chemically and biochemically protected pools that really better explain the responses of soil carbon levels to increasing inputs. And recent work from Catherine Stewart has looked at the dynamics of these protected pools and shown that with increasing carbon inputs, you see this the saturation where with increasing inputs, the soil carbon levels begin to sort of level off over time when steady state is reached, and which really suggests that there's a limit to the amount of carbon that can be stored in soils. And I think an interesting concept to come out of this is this idea of saturation deficit, which is shown here, this SD, and that idea is that the farther away a soil is from its theoretical level of saturation, the more or the greater proportion of carbon that can be stored given increasing carbon inputs. And so these concepts have really increased our mechanistic understanding of the dynamics of carbon cycling and carbon storage, but there's been comparatively little work that has looked at applying these concepts to the patterns of soil carbon on larger spatial scales, and what this might tell us or allow us to look at in terms of predicting what the potential is to store carbon with land management changes that increase carbon inputs, as well as allowing us to perhaps target specific locations on the landscape for land management practices that increase carbon inputs, and what the potential for storing carbon in those locations might be. Sort of a way of getting a bigger bang for your buck when it comes to land management changes and land use changes. So important in understanding this landscape level look at soil carbon is this concept of landscape heterogeneity. And what this cartoon shows is a sort of a typical hill slope where you have different landscape positions identified that potentially differ in ecosystem process rates that are important for carbon cycling and carbon storage. And so we're taking this framework of landscape heterogeneity and really using that to look at what are the differences in the potential to store carbon with changes in land management and land use. So we're addressing these questions at an experiment called the Landscape Biomass Experiment, located at the Uthe Farm in central Iowa. This is a Iowa State University research and demonstration farm. And it's located on a 35-hectare field that's been in conventional tilled corn and bean rotation for greater than 50 years. I think that's probably closer to about 100 years that it's been managed this way. And it's all of the entire field has been managed in this manner. We've got plots located on these same five landscape positions that I had identified in that previous slide. And so there's a topo sequence across these five landscape positions, as you can see in this map. You can tell by the aerial photo that these plots have different vegetation on them. They've got different cropping systems geared towards biofuels production. But I've removed that information from this map in the lower left-hand corner because this work was done at the beginning of the experiment when these cropping systems were just being established. And so really, this analysis is just looking at the impacts of landscape position. And so just to reiterate that, we're focusing on landscape position in this system, which was a conventionally tilled system across all the landscape positions, and specifically looking at carbon saturation deficit and soil aggregation. The methods used were 9 plots in each of the 5 landscape positions were sampled. 10 soil cores were sampled to 20 centimeters depth and composited into a single sample, which was split. Half was sieved to 2 millimeters and analyzed for carbon content and texture. And the other half was sieved to 8 millimeters and used for the aggregate fractionation. Now, I said this was done at the beginning of the experiment. These samples were actually collected at the end of the first growing season, so we did look at whole soil carbon contents and just to confirm that there were no cropping system effects after that first year. The aggregates were isolated by slaking for 5 minutes and then wet sieving, and these aggregate size classes were isolated according to this box here. Aggregates were oven dried and weighed to determine mass, and then subsamples analyzed for carbon content and sand content. All the fractions above 53 microns were then corrected for sand content, so all the data that I'll be showing here has been corrected for sand content. So this figure is showing the whole soil carbon content and the carbon protection capacity across these 5 landscape positions. So the red bars indicate the measured carbon content in the samples, and then the green bars indicate the protection capacity from the texture data, as determined by the relationship between carbon content with carbon inputs and silt and clay contents, determined by Six et al. In their 2002 publication. And what you can see is that across these landscape positions, there isn't any significant differences in both the carbon content and the protection capacity until you get down to this floodplain position here. And interestingly, you actually see greater carbon content than what you might predict based on this relationship here. And so that really the difference in the height of these two bars is sort of a measure of that saturation deficit, which is shown here. Saturation deficit was calculated according to Stewart et al. In their 2009 paper, which is just 1 minus the ratio of those 2 measures of carbon content and then the protection capacity. And so this really just emphasizes what we saw in that previous slide, which is that there really isn't any significant differences across these landscape positions until you get to the floodplain, where you actually have a negative saturation deficit or actually an excess of carbon. So for me, this was a really interesting result. This was, you know, really showing that that landscape position seems to matter, and got me wondering about where the carbon pools are and what maybe potentially hypothesizing what some of these mechanisms were for some of the differences. And so so we began to look at the aggregates. So these next two figures look at the aggregate work. We've got across the bottom here the 4 aggregate size classes going from the silt and clay fraction up to the large macro aggregates larger than 2 millimeters. And then these different colored bars within each size class are the different landscape positions going from the highest summit position down to the floodplain. And what you can see here is there's greater concentration of carbon as you go down the hill slope, with greater carbon concentrations in the floodplain positions for 3 out of the 4 aggregate size classes. The small aggregates weren't quite, the differences weren't quite as clear. This next figure then shows the mass of these aggregate fractions as calculated by the percent of dry soil. And really what stands out from looking here at this graph is that these larger size classes, the small macro aggregates here and the large macro aggregates, are significantly higher than in the floodplain than across the rest of the landscape positions. And then correspondingly, the micro aggregates and the silt and clay fraction then are less than the other 4 landscape positions. So really what this analysis is showing us is that that these floodplain soils really are standing out when looking at carbon at this landscape scale. So we've got big difference here in the saturation deficits, and when you look at the macro aggregates greater than 250 microns, so this is the small macro aggregates and the large macro aggregates combined, you see a pattern where you have both increasing carbon concentrations in the aggregates as you go down towards the floodplain, and then you see some really big differences in the mass or the percent of dry soil in these macro aggregates. And so this really results in a combined effect here where when you look at how much of the whole soil carbon is in present in these macro aggregates, you see a real big difference here in the floodplain. And this pattern here in these macro aggregates across the landscape positions really correlates well with the patterns that we're seeing in the saturation deficit. So conclusions basically are that the floodplain really stands out in terms of the carbon saturation, in terms of the aggregate data that we're seeing, and that really this combined effect of greater concentration in the floodplain and greater amounts in the floodplain really result in much more of the carbon being present in the macro aggregates, which really fits with sort of this hierarchical understanding of the importance of macro aggregates and carbon concentration, and that is at least correlated strongly with the patterns that we're seeing across the landscape in the saturation deficit. So I guess the take-home message here is that landscape position and landscape differences really do matter. This has implications then for looking at the potential to store carbon from land use changes, looking at regional scales or landscape scales, as well as maybe targeting where specific land management practices might be able to be targeted for carbon sequestration. So with that, I'll take any questions. Yeah, we did take soil cores down to 120 centimeters depth, and you can see down at the lower depths in the floodplain, you can see some evidence of redox conditions. And it's important to note when you look, if you can kind of tell from this aerial photo here, there's a creek right here. This creek has been channelized and straightened out, and so there's been a lot of down cutting occurring. And so this floodplain sort of hydrologically has been disconnected from the water table, but we had some big floods this summer, as you might know, and so there was flooding on the floodplain. We did have water moving over it, and so there is evidence that, at least not quite as frequently, but there is saturated conditions on the floodplain still.
Yes, please.
I don't know exactly how steep the slope was on the back slope position, which is a fairly uniform slope. The difference in elevation is 20 meters across 400 meters, which is the distance from the summit to the floodplain. Some of that, there's stable, flat areas. So it's approximately between 5 to 7% slope on the back slope, I would estimate. But I don't have exact data on that.
Okay, thank you very much. Final questions, please. Connect.